Hey folks, Scott Weingart here. Welcome to an MCrit Wii. This Wii is a debate on beta blockers for cocaine toxicity, for stimulant toxicity, for cocaine exposure. Yes or no? We've classically been told cocaine beta blockers do not mix. And yet there's been two interesting posts on the matter that really spurred this debate. First, on the Life in the Fast Lane blog, John Richards, professor of emergency medicine at UC Davis, someone incredibly interested in beta blockers, made a rather provocative post challenging what he described as the dogma that has caused us to feel there's a prohibition against beta blockers and cocaine toxicity and exposure. And then a rebuttal a couple years later by our second guest, Jeff LaPointe, toxicologist, director of medical toxicology at Kaiser San Diego. And there's been a little bit of a flame war on Twitter between the two. And I thought, wow, provocative topic, a little bit of stirring the pot would be a lot of fun. So I thought I'd bring them both onto MCrit. Now, what ensued was an incredibly polite, erudite, and at least from the perspective of seeing fireworks, disappointing discussion. But from the perspective of learning, I think it was absolutely fantastic. Now, the full conversation was about an hour. I'm going to release the unabridged version in the show notes of this. What you were listening to is a edited version down to about a half hour. I think I got most of the key points, but if this is really a topic that interests you, then you could just listen to the unabridged version that is linked there. And without any further ado, we'll get right into it. I guess the first question we'll go to, I think this is the money question, is should beta blockers be used in patients with cocaine toxicity? And the first part of that is, how would each of you define cocaine toxicity for the purpose of this conversation? You want to start this one, Jeff?
Yeah, sure. I guess I'm looking for a classic sympathomimetic toxidrome. I'm looking for someone who's tachycardic, who's hypertense, who has diaphoresis, mydriasis, hyperthermia. Those are the things, that psychomotor agitation. Those are the things I want to see some central effects. I want to see some autonomic instability. And these are people that I think we all walk into the room and we say, this guy's sick, right? Not like, oh yeah, maybe he's anxious. It's not like that. It's like, this person's sick. Everyone walks in that room and says, man, this guy's sick. The nurse says, we're having trouble keeping the leads on him. That's cocaine toxicity.
All right. Very fair description. That's how I'm picturing this patient as well. John, are you happy with that definition for the purpose of this question, or do we need to alter it?
Well, I think we can expand it a bit to the most common presentations of cocaine users in the emergency department. And quite frankly, most of the ones we see come in with chest pain, tachycardia, and hypertension. And I would say all three of those to me equals cocaine toxicity. And I think that's part of the discussion here that we've been having. You know, the grandfathers of cocaine publications in the field of toxicology are Lewis Goldfrank, Lewis Nelson, and Bob Hoffman. And in preparation for this, I emailed each one of those and I said, hey, would you consider a patient with chest pain and or hypertension, tachycardia, or acute heart failure immediately following cocaine use to be a definition of someone who's cocaine toxic? So Lewis Goldfrank replied, he said, dear John, the scenario you present is totally consistent with cocaine toxicity. And he was a little suspicious. He said, and I would presume there is a more detailed information that has led you to ask such a fundamental question. Lewis Nelson got back to me and he said, I would say that is largely true within a few hours of use, depending on quantity. So for me, acute toxicity is the patient who comes to the emergency department after using cocaine with tachycardia, with hypertension, with chest pain. Basically, something brought them into the emergency department. And to me, that's a toxic patient and they need some sort of treatment.
All right. So that's also fair. So if you guys agree, I say we take those as two separate issues. And let's first deal with the patient Jeff laid out. And let's, for the purpose of this, call that the really sick cocaine toxicity patient. And let's deal with that. And then I think we could hit that second case as well, because I'm curious to see if there's any variance in your opinions, Jeff, in those patients. But let's deal with the first one first. This patient is sweaty. They are looking like death. They do not look good. Is this a patient where we would worry about unopposed alpha with beta blockers? And does that phenomenon even exist? And we'll start with you, John. Is this a real thing?
Yeah, so unopposed alpha is a real phenomenon. And I actually wrote a very extensive chapter in my book on beta blockers regarding this. We looked at not only cocaine, but also the other stimulants, methamphetamine, exercise, both cardiovascular and hyperdynamic exercise, and then also pheochromocytoma as well. And what we found is that, yes, it does exist, especially in patients who are exercising. So it is a real phenomenon. With the truly toxic cocaine patients that you described, and by the way, they're very rare, but when they do come in, they are very impressive in all their symptoms. I think unopposed alpha is a risk, and I think it's one thing that you would take into consideration in using beta blockers in a patient like that. And it's no different from using benzodiazepines. I think benzodiazepines are an excellent first choice. The problem is a lot of times they just don't do the job and you have to keep escalating the doses and increasing the frequency. The problem is you have patients who are very resistant to benzos and you have to have other, you know, arrows in your quiver to treat them. And that's where beta blockers come in. That's where phentolamine comes in, nitrates, nitroprusside, hydralazine, other things like that. And then of course, cooling them down is very important too. So I think you have to have different ways of treating patients, and the fact that benzos have been described as being safe, I think, is misleading. They're a scheduled drug for a reason. They cause respiratory depression, they cause oversedation, and they cause paradoxical agitation. You know, you have an excellent article on paradoxical agitation on your website, Scott, that I think is a good example of when it goes bad, what's going to be your backup plan?
Yeah. So, John, you kind of gone into the third question as well. So why don't we continue that question to see if you have anything to say, and then Jeff could address both of those issues. So let me really just put your feet to the fire. Are beta blockers safe in the patient with what we're describing as really sick cocaine toxicity? And do you have any evidence to support in that patient population that beta blockers are safe?
No. And all the cases of unopposed alpha with cocaine patients, of which there are very few, there were no extreme toxicity cases like that, where they're really, you know, at death's doorstep. So we don't really know. And so what we can do is we can say, okay, if we have to use beta blockers, we should anticipate this possibly happening. And that's basically true of any drug that we give in the emergency department, even if it's Tylenol. There are implications to everything that we use. And so I think the answer is we don't know about the safety. There are no real cases of extreme toxicity in beta blockers. The cases that do exist are very inconsistent. They're variable. They're unpredictable. So that's what I would say on those particular patients.
All right, Jeff, we're going to send this to you and we'll do both of those. I want you to discuss your viewpoint on unopposed alpha and whether you think beta blockers are unsafe in these patients and what evidence you have to support your viewpoint.
So, and there's a lot there. I think that, you know, it's funny. It's like every time John and I talk, we end up mostly agreeing.
Yeah, this has been already far more docile than I was expecting.
We get on the goddamn Twitter and, you know, you never know what's going to happen. So, the thing is that unopposed alpha, it may exist, but it's not informing my decision to use benzodiazepines and avoid beta blockers. I'm not looking at this boogeyman and saying, gosh, if it wasn't for unopposed alpha, I could use these beta blockers that are life-saving. That's not what I'm thinking. I'm thinking, all right, I have something safe, titratable, that works on the central pathophysiology of what I'm treating. Right at that synapse, I'm going to hit it with GABA. I know how to use these very well. And look, you know, I'm not really worried in the doses and the frequency that I use benzodiazepine. No one is going to have a paradoxical reaction. I can guarantee you. I'm giving 10 milligrams every 3 minutes until you're the human being I want you to be of diazepam. And that's how it's going to go. And then at some point I'm going to switch to a bigger hammer, like a barb. and then I'm going to use propofol. But yeah, you know, in terms of the hemodynamics, John mentioned phentolamine. I think that that's a reasonable choice. I will use nicardipine if I have to. I'm pretty good with both of those. Nitrates are fine. But the thing about beta blockers, with maybe the exception of esmolol, is that I'm all in. If I give them this, I'm all in. If they have a hemodynamic collapse, then what? What am I going to do? So that's why I tended to back off. It's not because I think there's this unopposed alpha cringe somewhere, and there may be, I don't know. But it's because I know how to use these medications very, very quickly. And if you're that sick and you have respiratory depression and you get intubated when you're that sick from cocaine, like, I'm okay with it. I'm good with it. That might be an endpoint anyways.
Yeah. John, do you have you want to respond to that before we go further?
Yeah, you know, I respect that. Like the extreme cocaine toxic patient, absolutely. You give them large doses of benzos. Let's face it, they're already going to be agitated or comatose, so they're not going to have paradoxical agitation anyway. But, you know, if you have a patient that's kind of midway, I published a very first case of dual cocaine and meth toxicity with a poison center director of Louisiana and also Oregon. And the problem with that case is he came in pretty agitated, but we gave him a couple doses of Ativan and he became even more agitated. So we then switched to beta blocker, which worked very well. So I thought, you know, there's a range of patients and toxicities, but I tend to think that the ones that we see the most in the emergency department are the guys who come in after snorting some lines, they get some chest pain, they get hypertensive and tachycardic. Now, not extreme, maybe in the 150s to 180s and maybe at a heart rate of 150s. But these are the guys that we have to kind of treat and look at and how are we going to treat. And that's what I think is what most of the clinicians are looking for, is some direction. And if they look to the textbooks, they're going to see that cocaine is contraindicated or beta blockers are contraindicated in any cocaine patient. And I think that needs to be clarified. And Jeff has touched on that too. You know, clarifying which patients should get what I think is very important.
So, you know, we're at, oh, I'm sorry, Jeff.
So can I just add one thing? Yeah. And I agree with almost everything that John said, except I would make a suggestion for the clinicians. If you need to rapidly titrate something, maybe lorazepam is not your jam, because you really got to wait 15 minutes for the max peak effect of that CNS-wise. So what we always joke is, like, we talk about lorazepam 2, 4, 6, paralyzed intubate. Right. But I'll know everything diazepam or midazolam is going to do in 3 to 5 minutes. And that's beautiful because I can just go. And I don't have to wait. If you are losing lorazepam, I think that's a large challenge, and it would affect the amount of failures you see because you can't really escalate as aggressively.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And, you know, just for the people listening who might not have the same experience using these large doses of easily titratable benzodiazepines, you know, coming from a New York Poison Center training, this was given every 60 seconds for our alcohol withdrawal patients, and 200, 400 milligrams would, in no way, we wouldn't even bat an eyelash on this. And the patients don't stop breathing. There is not respiratory depression. And you can get a patient exactly where you needed, which I think is what you're alluding to, Jeff. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Now, midazolam, you know, I don't know if the poison center switched over. That makes a lot more sense to me for patients that have a situation that's going to resolve. You know, it always made sense for alcohol withdrawal because they're going to need 2-3 days right. of benzodiazepines on board at their GABA. But for cocaine toxicity, which can be a much more short-lived situation, midaz makes a lot of sense. Have you had experience with that, Jeff?
Yeah, I trained at the poison center at New York City Poison Center at Bellevue during a time when we ran out of diazepam, and then we ran out of lorazepam. So we have actually really fun experiencing using different benzos for different things, whether it's alcohol withdrawal or, yeah, I mean, I can do alcohol withdrawal, midazolam and chlordiazepoxide. I have to. It's kind of fun. But yeah, I mean, yeah, I think midazolam does make a lot of sense because you're not all in, just like the other thing.
So now we come to the next question, and this is really where I've been confused about this whole debate. Okay, we could bandy back and forth, and we will talk about the less severe cocaine toxicity in a second, and maybe there'll be a different viewpoint on this. But I don't understand either group, even if they were safe, why there's any compelling reason to ever use them for any purpose. Even if the heart rate was the only thing left and I wanted an agent that just dealt with that with no other added benefits, why wouldn't I use a calcium channel blocker like diltiazem? Why would a beta blocker ever be in play if there's even a potential for toxicity?
Yeah, well, a great question. And, you know, cocaine toxicity and calcium channel blockers are something that we looked at in our systematic review. The thing about calcium channel blockers, the ones that the studies that we looked at, it was effective at controlling blood pressure, but not necessarily heart rate.
Hey folks, Weingart here popping in. Now, obviously I pulled this article and looked at it, and they never tested IV diltiazem, and they didn't test any of these IV heart rate control calcium channel blockers at any dose or any route that would be reasonably chosen in an emergency department. Most of these were oral, most of these were vasodilatory calcium channel blockers. And so in no way would I say that this review of the extant literature says that IV diltiazem wouldn't perfectly control tachydysrhythmias in cocaine toxic patients. So now we'll get back to the show.
And so what we were looking at is, what is the best medication that kind of does both? And if you think about it, the best medication would be a combined beta and alpha blocker, such as labetalol or carbetalol. And definitely those are medications that have never had any unopposed alpha cases written up about them, and make sense teleologically from, you know, the pharmacology standpoint, because you're basically blocking, you know, exogenous catecholamines in the periphery. But since labetalol is also lipophilic, it also does penetrate the CNS as well, and can provide some antagonism there as well. So I think, you know, thinking that once we give a beta blocker, we can't control it, or, you know, we've passed the point of no return, I don't think that's true. I think, you know, we should have a lot of different arrows in our quiver as far as drugs go. And the problem with phentolamine is, again, it treats the hypertension but not tachycardia. And quite frankly, it's not available in our Pyxis system. I tried ordering it once, and I was told, you know, hey, we don't have it in Pyxis. We'll mix it up for you in about an hour. And then a few years ago, there was a huge shortage nationwide. So, you know, it's not a drug that we're really familiar with.
I guess the difference when you look at the non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers, and so we're looking at stuff that also doesn't just act on the periphery, it acts on that AV node. And those are the things we're trying to stay away from. I mean, if you put this out there and say, how many people have gotten into a little trouble going over aggressive on an AFib patient with DILT? Well, you're fine. All three of us have seen either been signed out or done primarily and been like, oh man, I got the AV node and I got the peripheral calcium channel node, right? Like, cocaine doesn't just have problems with heart rate and blood pressure. What about the sodium channel blockade? What about the heat? What about maybe the hyperthermia, right? What about the psychomotor agitation? And I don't think labetalol, you know, John mentions labetalol is lipophilic. I don't think that any of us are going to reach for labetalol when there's a 200-pound dude charging us. Is anyone saying, like, I am labetalol, you know, to get this guy down, right? Like, it doesn't penetrate the CNS to a point where it's really going to control psychomotor agitation. So that's why we tend to stay away from those things. We tend to stay away from things that what happens when we have a cardiovascular collapse, or who's gonna have a cardiovascular collapse? Who, you know, there's no case of unopposed alpha with labetalol, but why would I keep pushing to find that one? Why would I, like, let's find the edges on this. Like, how can I find harm with this drug? I don't know. That's the part that worries me, that someone's not everyone's John. You know, John is incredibly well published. He's brilliant on this. But if you throw that out to everyone, they go, well, let's just see what happens. Like, that's what I don't want to happen.
John, you described a patient who is hypertensive, tachycardic, and has some chest pain, but they are not looking like they're going to die in the stretcher. They're sitting there. They might be complaining a little bit. They might be asking for some opioids, but they're not looking like death, like the patient Jeff originally described. Would you be using beta blockers in that patient? It sounds like you've alluded to the fact you already will, but why don't you talk about that for a minute?
Yeah. So first off, I would try some benzodiazepines. And if I was pushing heavy doses and high frequency and not working very well, I would then go to a beta blocker. The beta blocker I would choose would be metoprolol if they were just tachycardic. If they're hypertensive and tachycardic, I would choose labetalol. And the reason for that is metoprolol is a beta 1, and it's also lipophilic, so it also gets in the CNS. And then, as we mentioned, labetalol is beta 1, beta 2, and alpha 1 as well. So you get that combination blockade.
And just for the really logistical perspective, what dose of labetalol would you be giving that patient on that first shot?
So I would start them at 10 milligrams IV And I would give them another 10 or 20 milligram aliquot. If that did not work, I would call it a day. I would not go further with it.
Okay, Jeff, respond.
Yeah, I would use, you know, high escalating doses of benzos till, you know, a CNS target point. If that didn't work, I think nitrates are a great call here, something that makes sense. And, you know, it's something that's not going to last forever. I can titrate it. I can put you on a drip. I've got a lot of like cool things to play with. Then I can go to a dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker if I need to. And those would be my main ways to do it. I find very few people, even in this category, that I can't really control well with really quick, fast escalating doses of benzos. Once I get to that CNS endpoint, I'm finding that the peripheral stuff gone. That just makes sense. Pathophysiologically, look at that. It just makes sense. If I have a central problem, I have a central neurotransmitter problem. So I very rarely find people that I've just knocked down that are still just tacking away at hypertensive.
Jeff, when you're saying a CNS endpoint, this guy's already relatively comfortable in bed. Do you mean now he's drowsy and that's the endpoint you're going for?
Yeah. I start getting to like a nice little RAS -1.
Okay.
You know, yep. Eyes closed, resting comfortably, wakes to voice. I love that. Like that's nature's hugs right there.
All right. Let's acid test this, Jeff. Your resident had listened to John. He heard him at a lecture or something. And, you know, he was a senior resident. He didn't come to you first. And he did exactly what John had recommended on this patient. He gave him a couple doses of metoprolol or, you know, labetalol. What would you say to that resident? Would you tell him you failed, or would you tell him you just don't think this is a good idea? And, you know, until there's better evidence, what would be your response?
No, I wouldn't tell him that. I think that, you know, there's two great points to make here for me is that I'm not going to yell at anyone. There's no harm there. There's no harm there. I would say that, what would you do if something bad happened? What's your plan? Right? Because that's like, you know what I mean? If you're asking me about an airway, you're really asking me, what am I going to do if the airway doesn't work? What's my backup? That's what the attending's really asking, trying to get down the line. And then the other thing is like, you know, we're in the special age of medical education, a phone. Like how did he evaluate that evidence? He or she evaluate that evidence that John gave? How did they think it through? How did they appraise its validity? And I would say, does this make sense? As far as pathophysiology, and are there alternatives? You know, there. When we think about using a medication, there's two big questions. Is it safe? And that's kind of what we're playing with. We're batting that around a little bit today. But the other question is it efficacious? And we don't even know, right? So I'm not that interested in experimenting on my patients. We had an animal model. I think John and I should just go there all the time. Let's get some mice. And sorry if anyone listening is a big fan of mice or pigs or whatever, but like, and just get after it and find out exactly where in mammals this is. But I can't do that on my patient, especially when I've got a way that I'm really good at and that's pretty safe. And that's just what I would tell a resident. I don't yell at residents. That's not my style, but that's how I would tell them to approach it.
Why don't we move on to the next category? For either of you, do your thoughts that you've very nicely expressed change if it's not cocaine, if the patient gives a clean story of other stimulants? Jeff, why don't we start with you? Are your feelings different if it's not cocaine, one of the other sympathomimetics?
No, I mean, yeah, I need to know the pathophysiology. You know, sometimes if I just don't know anything and they come in sympathomimetic, I'm probably going to do a lot of the same things that I did. You know, I know that, you know, what we really don't talk about a lot is that, you know, thermoregulation and being, you know, having a really bad, you know, high temperature, that's a horrible prognostic indicator for any sympathomimetic kind of activity. There are certain stimulants that I will reach for beta blocker. Like if you come in and, you know, you've had a bunch and you're caffeine toxic and I look at your echo and you're not filling, I'm going to slow you down. I'm going to use Esmolol, and we've done that before and it's really effective. It's a wonderful drug to do that. There's some things that have specific toxicity that I might, a fluorinated hydrocarbon, like inhalation. So these people do, you know, these kids huff or something. Usually they're dead or resolved by the time you get them. But if I was in the field and I knew that they did that and their blood pressure is falling because they can't pump any blood, I'm going to slow them down. That's exactly what I would use because they're really sensitive to that catechol surge. But for the most part, those things don't change. I don't often get to know exactly where it is. So I kind of like, we'll go the safest route, obviously. And my starting point is like, you know, good dose of benzodiazepines. But I don't think unopposed alpha is the boogeyman hiding in methylxanthine toxicity. I don't think it's the boogeyman hiding in methamphetamine toxicity. But also methamphetamine toxicity doesn't have any cardiac channel blockade that I have to really worry about, right? And methylxanthines have their own special toxicity, usually seizures with like the alpha and stuff like that. But yeah, the drug makes a big difference to me, and I can usually kind of get an idea of the pathophysiology by looking at what's going on with the patient. But unopposed alpha is not like the big boogeyman, all those other things.
That's a good answer. John, let me put your feet to the fire on this one. If you really believed in beta blockers, and I think you do, why not esmolol? I mean, it seems like this is already somewhat of a fraught situation. You have something out there easily available. It's in every ED now that you could give and always take away if there was an issue. Why not choose something that is immediately vanishing?
It's a great question. I love esmolol. I like the fact that it's got a very short half-life. So if you do run into trouble, you can just turn it off. And the problem is it's usually takes some time to get it set up. If you've ever ordered it, it can take a few minutes. Whereas usually, you know, you can do the metoprolol pretty quickly or labetalol. But I totally agree that esmolol is a great choice.
I can't think of a beta blocker I use that's not called esmolol.
Yeah. All right. Fair enough. <Yeah. laughs> Okay. So let's go to the last part of this. We're perfect on time. And this situation, it happened at an imaginary hospital. It's an imaginary patient, but you got a 48-year-old. He's a type 1 diabetic. He's hypertensive, has high cholesterol, presents with substernal chest pain. But he is a cocaine user. He says he swears up and down he hasn't done it for a day, but his urine drug screen is positive for cocaine. And we'll make it 2 days ago just to really drive this point home. And he absolutely denies up and down any use today. And he's been forthcoming about all his other drug use. He told you about his LSD trips in college. You really believe this guy. He has no reason to lie. The pathway at your hospital is to use CTCA for these patients. He obviously has risk factors beyond the cocaine for actually having coronary vessel disease. The radiologist takes a look at this urine drug screen and says, absolutely not, because they require beta blockers for their protocol. They have no protocol for calcium channel blockers. It's not even an option. And they just refuse to do the scan. Are they justified or not?
You want me to start?
Yeah, John, you could start. Sure.
Sure. Well, of course, they're not justified. And, you know, one of the things that's been created here is essentially a dogma. It's an easy rule to repeat. And that is, do not use beta blockers for cocaine patients. That's an easy one that I think everyone can remember. And that's a great example of that. Now, the problem is that's spilled over into other stimulants as well. But it's basically boiled down to, you know, if you ask someone, oh, can you use a beta blocker if you have a patient using cocaine? They'll say, absolutely not. And it doesn't matter if it's extreme toxicity or if they're an occasional user. They'll just say, no, can't do it. And I think that's one of the things that I've been trying to address using an evidence-based approach and seeking out, you know, advice from other people who published published in that field. And, you know, I'm getting there. I think it's going to take a while, and a new generation of physicians who don't really know the old dogma that it's really going to change. And a lot of the studies that are coming out now, there's some very large prospective and retrospective studies that have been coming out where they're using beta blockers and not, you know, maybe not acutely in the emergency department, but they're using them for cocaine using patients with cardiomyopathy. Because let's face it, that's the only thing that's going to help remodel the heart back to normal if they cease using the cocaine or methamphetamine for that matter. And I know, Jeff, you probably have a big problem with meth down in San Diego. We don't see as much cocaine out in the West Coast. And we're seeing so much methamphetamine-associated cardiomyopathy that these guys have to be on beta blockers. It's their only hope, really. And it's real sad. If you have patients coming in their 30s and 40s with ejection fractions of 10%, you can pretty much chalk it up to some sort of stimulant.
Jeff, why don't you respond on the case?
Yeah, I mean, the case, I mean, we agree. Yeah, we totally agree. And we agree in the way that, you know, our job is to be physicians, not technicians. And, you know, and just like when the radiology tech calls me in the middle of the night and said the patient who is a mammal is allergic to iodine. And I'm like, no, they're not. They're not allergic to iodine. You know, so, you know, we approach things like that. And if it's a person that has normal vital signs and my pretest probability, you know, I feel like I'm the drug screen. As the emergency physician or critical care physician, you are the drug screen. You look at the patient, I don't think you're toxic. Like that's good enough for me. And I would go down and tell the radiologist the same, let's sign off. And I think that's unreasonable. Now, John makes a really good point. And there is a problem with dogma, but dogma lysis is just as dangerous. So if you have a dogma, the dogma lysis needs to be so much more expanded and nuanced. If the dogma lysis is just as simple as the dogma, in this case, no beta blockers ever for cocaine, Flip it over. Beta blockers are safe for cocaine. Now we've got just as dangerous a situation. So, you know, that's what we try to tell the new physicians, you know, just if you're going to think about a dogma or whatever, it has to be very, like, I'm not saying to respect the dogma or to believe in it, but I'm saying you can create new dogma if you're not very nuanced in the debunking of something.
Wow, that was a lot of fun. Not as many fireworks as I was hoping for, but I guess that's good. It means that we actually had a polite and useful conversation. To sum it up, and this is my perspective, not the perspective of either of my guests, so don't blame them and don't get angry. In true cocaine toxicity, as the way Jeff described, patients dying in front of you, hypertensive emergency, all riled up, I can't say from this conversation whether beta blockers are definitively dangerous, though, as John mentioned, the studies didn't include these patients. We don't know, but I think Jeff's point is the real take home, which is whether we know or not doesn't matter because there's no reason to use those agents in these patients. For true cocaine toxicity, your first line is going to be benzodiazepines. And in my opinion, that should probably be midazolam or diazepam, because neither of those agents will stack. If you're using Ativan, otherwise known as lorazepam, you cannot give that medication with the frequency you really need to get control of these patients, because it's going to take a while to see their full effects, and therefore you might stack on top of an already too far dose. I guess if that's all you had, then you got to work with it. But the best thing in my mind is midazolam or diazepam. Now, that alone should do most of the work on the patient's mental status, on their temp, and on their heart rate control. If there's still blood pressure control you need, then it makes a lot of sense to me to use a nicardipine drip. It's easy off, it's titratable, and it really has no possibility of problems. I guess you could use phentolamine, but I don't think many of us are familiar with it. I don't think many of us have it available. And I don't think many of us know not just the initial dose, which you could just look up, but how frequently we would dose it when you're ready to give more. When you already have an agent you should be using, in my opinion, for every single hypertensive emergency, like nicardipine, or if you're really rich, clavidipine, either one will work. This makes a lot of sense for pure arterial blood pressure control. Now, what no one's spoken about, and I'd probably add in, is dexmedetomidine as a possibility. It does good stuff to both heart rate, blood pressure, and it's going to directly hit the receptor you're trying to block, which is the alpha receptor. Haven't seen literature on it, but it makes a lot of sense to me. On your middle patients, yeah, John might have a better point of the safety of beta blockers in these patients, but I go back to Jeff's point, which is whether it's safe or not, why? Why do it? We have benzodiazepines in these patients. You might choose Ativan in these patients. They don't need as much or as frequent a dosing regimen, so you might get away with it, though there's no reason you couldn't use midazolam or diazepam in these patients as well. If there's chest pain as a component, add in some nitroglycerin. And if, I mean, it's really the blood pressure that's getting you upset, then you still have the things like nicardipine that will temporize very nicely. I still don't see a huge utility of beta blockers in this group, though John's studies that he put in his systematic review did bear on this group, and the likelihood of a bad outcome seems small, but the problem is the biased reporting in all studies leads harm to be underrepresented. So I don't know. I don't mean that John's study is biased. I mean the studies that went into John's study may be biased by a reporting bias. Now, what everyone agrees to is that you cannot take these problems that are potential with cocaine and apply them to other stimulants like methamphetamines or especially caffeine, in which case beta blockers are either safe or actually indicated. If you want to hear or see more about this stuff, then read the two original posts. I think you should do that no matter what because they're excellent and enjoyable. Read John's work on this. Check out Jeff's other stuff on various toxicology issues because he's a brilliant guy, and I will leave it there. I hope there is lots of controversy in the comment section, so put them on over there at the MCRIT site. I'm curious to hear what you think. Scott Weingart for the MCRIT podcast saying bye-bye.